we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
Welcome to Hard Facts, the show that gets to the heart of the matter with me, John White. Well, I suppose amid the ongoing controversial and surreal US presidential election, perhaps the most controversial and surreal in recent times, involving a candidate in the shape of Donald Trump, who clearly is a man who should be kept away from political office in the way that a three-year-old should be kept away from a box of matches, and his opponent in the shape of Hillary Clinton, who I contend is a natural-born killer, a US political figure and prospective leader who believes there is no country that cannot be improved by showering cruise missiles and Tomahawk missiles on it. I suppose amid that controversy, in conjunction with the escalating crisis and conflict in Syria, which has brought Moscow and Washington closer to direct military confrontation than at any time since the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, I suppose amid all that, it is perhaps understandable that the seismic vote taken by the US Congress to overturn President Obama's veto of the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, which would enable citizens of the US to bring civil suits against foreign governments for alleged involvement in terrorist attacks against the US involving US victims, would not receive the attention it should have or normally would have in the American media. But that in no way negates the seismic nature of this vote, because what it does is it shines a harsh light on Saudi and US relations, perhaps the harshest light that's ever been shone on that relationship between both countries since they were first brought into being at the end of the Second World War. And now here's Joanna to give us some background detail.
It's now been a year and a half since Saudi Arabia began its onslaught of Yemen, a war which, despite growing international criticism, has not prevented continued arms sales from the West to the Saudis. A UN report in January found there had been 119 coalition attacks that breached international humanitarian law, with many involving multiple airstrikes on multiple civilian objects, such as hospitals, schools, factories and homes. The British government alone has spent in excess of £3.3 billion in arms exports to Saudi Arabia in the past year, and the quantity of bombs exceeded the total sold by the UK in the previous 4 years. The hypocrisy of Western governments in their attitude to Saudi Arabia has long been highlighted, as the nature of the relationship traditionally ignores the horrific human rights record the Gulf state holds. Here's John Kirby, spokesperson for the US State Department, answering a question on why the US refuses to take action over the Yemen conflict.
We have a strong defence relationship with Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia is under attack from
hospitals, schools in Yemen.
Excuse me. Saudi Arabia is under attack from missiles that are finding their way into Yemen with the help of Iran, that are raining down on Saudi citizens. And they have a right to defend themselves.
The importance of the US-Saudi strategic relationship for some was made even more apparent by the recent decision of President Barack Obama to veto the bill passed by Congress allowing victims of 9/11 to sue the Saudi government. Despite Obama's reason being that it would set a dangerous precedent, it has been suggested that this is further evidence of a reluctance to upset the Saudi leadership. To gauge public opinion on the subject, we went out onto the streets of Edinburgh to ask, what do you think of Western policy towards Saudi Arabia?
Not entirely, but I don't feel I'm clued up enough to answer it.
I'm not sure what Western policy is, like, in detail.
Well, Saudi Arabia, I mean, I don't really like the policies that they are taking in Saudi Arabia, but I don't think that is this hypocrisy from the Western potencies, I would say, that they are just at the same time making business with them and selling arms and lots of things.
They should brainstorm together and find a proper solution that will benefit all those countries, not just like Saudi Arabia, but all the countries near that area.
Yes and no. I think the situation in the Middle East in general is a tough one, that we're almost going about it too strongly, and it's really a cultural clash. And I think a lot of policymakers are forgetting to go back and sort of realize that they're not working in the West, and you have to be aware. I mean, it's one of the things I work over in history of art, and we talk about the global middle ages and how things were clashing then. And I think there's a lot to be said about learning and actually knowing who you're working with from a cultural perspective that I think a lot of people forget about.
Okay, thanks, Joanna. Now, I'm delighted to be joined by Daniel Pipes, from the United States. Daniel is a distinguished scholar, academic, and US foreign policy analyst. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thank you. That was quite an introduction.
I'd like to start by posing a counterfactual question, which I think really penetrates to the heart of the hypocrisy or contradiction, if you will, in US-Saudi relations, and it is this. Imagine if 15 of the 19 hijackers of 9/11 had been Syrian or Iranian nationals and not Saudi nationals. What do we think the response of Washington would have been? It surely would have been worse, would it not?
No, I don't think so, unless it was seen to be an act sponsored by the government. And in the case of 9/11, it was not fully clear. It's still a matter of controversy and argument how much the government of Saudi Arabia sponsored this act. And the general sense is that it sponsored it in the abstract. That is to say that the government teaches a form of Islam that is disdainful and aggressive towards non-Muslims, but it doesn't actually encourage acts of violence such as 9/11.
Well, that's an interesting point because you're right, it is underpinned by a very extreme interpretation of Islam, Sunni Islam, to be frank and to be precise. And this is in service to the Wahhabi religious establishment, which really underpins the moral authority of the Saudi government. And I think the Saudis, it's fair to say, have played a very clever game going back many years in speaking out of two sides of its mouth at the same time, i.e. it has a different message to its Western allies and Western audiences, and also a different message to its adherents, its Sunni adherents in the Wahhabi establishment. And I think what this congressional vote and this civil action by the families of the victims by 9/11, who, by the way, I think we should agree deserve huge credit for pursuing this issue, and it really is to the discredit of the Obama administration that they would try and deny them their search and their rightful search for justice. And we'll get on to that in a second, if I may. But I think this contradiction within the Saudi establishment in terms of its policy towards the West vis-a-vis its policy towards its own adherents in terms of trying to bolster its credits amongst a very fundamentalist strain of Sunni Islam, which is obviously led directly to the formation of ISIS, I think it's now hit the buffers, hasn't it, with this congressional vote?
The U.S.-Saudi relationship has always been an easy one. You point out correctly that it began in the aftermath of World War II, say 70 years ago. It's always been deeply uneasy in that, put simply, there is no country in the world more different than Saudi Arabia from the United States. There are a few countries that have goals that are as different of those of the Saudis than our own, and so forth. It has been an alignment of convenience. They have the energy, we have the security to offer them, to protect themselves and their energy, and it has weathered many, many challenges before, including 9/11. I suspect it will continue to weather them simply because both sides see this as an important bond, and also because the Saudis have been particularly clever in their approach to the United States. I would say that the Saudi presence in Washington and the United States differs from any other governments anywhere in the world.
Yeah, I think there's a lot in that. But even so, I mean, this sounds like it's more pragmatic than principle that informs US relations with Saudi Arabia, which I understand in terms of a state it has its own strategic interests. However, it does negate, as I said in my opening remarks, the claims of the US to stand for democracy and human rights.
I think your statement was very much too strong. The United States has been, since a century ago, since World War I, the standard bearer of democracy around the world. The United States and Britain share much in common, but the British government has never had this moral quality to it that began with Woodrow Wilson in World War I. Now, it's not to say the U.S. government is made up of angels, not to say that Americans don't look after their own interests at times and sacrifice this moral dimension, but broadly speaking, the United States is the force, the U.S. government is the force that has pushed for democracy, pushed for all that goes with democracy, rule of law, minority rights, and so forth around the world. No one else has done this. It's a uniquely American career. Yes, it's faltered. It's made the U.S. government's made mistakes, but simply to accuse it of hypocrisy and nothing else, I think, is to miss. In other words, one can look at the U.S. record and find nothing but errors and tragedies, but that would miss the larger arc of American foreign policy, which has been by and large a success.
On what grounds? How do you interpret success? Define success for me, Daniel, please.
Well, let me put it this way. We're the ones who ended World War One. We're the ones who ended
au
World
contraire,
War II.
Au contraire, Daniel. Daniel.
Well, I don't know. Let's just stick to the Saudi topic. No. But this is the way I see the United States. I don't think we'll change each other's minds. But on the Saudi topic, yeah, this is a particularly difficult relationship for Americans to swallow. I myself have written extensively about the dishonesty of it, the uniqueness of it, the way the Saudis have achieved a beachhead in Washington, working with retired senators, flag officers, ambassadors, and the like, in a very corrupt way that no other government has done. But it is an important relationship. And these days, when the Saudis are face-to-face with the Iranians, I, who have little sympathy for the Saudi government, have to say that I'm more on their side than on the Iranian side. They are more a force of stability and less a force of aggression than Tehran.
Really, you would say that despite the formation of ISIS, despite the role of the Saudis in funding these different groups, you would suggest that the Iranians who haven't,
I would say that, it's Hobson's choice. But yes, the Saudis are preferable. They're not trying to overturn the established order in the way the Iranians are trying.
What established order is that, Daniel?
Well, the Iranians wish to change their revanches. They wish to change everything they can in the Middle East and beyond. The Saudis are far more status quo-oriented and accept the existing order and work within it.
Can I ask you again to enlarge on that? What do you mean by the existing order? What order is that? Whose order is it? And whose interest is this order established? And how does it work?
Well, there is an order around the world. There are governments, states, granted in the region of the Middle East, many of them are in collapse these days, but there is an order. The Iranian government seeks to overthrow it, wants to grab as much as it can, and is fighting aggressively in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen at this point, and could well extend its aggression to the north and to the east. It is the prime disruptor of the Middle East these days.
But don't you think Saudi Arabia's role in the region has been a major cause of its destabilization over the last few years?
I do think the Saudi, beyond the region, the Saudis' vast investment in Wahhabi propaganda has been harmful in Bosnia and the Philippines and most everywhere in between. Yes, I completely agree. But still, given the choice, I would opt for the Saudis rather than the Iranians.
But how about this choice, Daniel? How about an even-handed policy where if you're going to declaim against the lack of democracy in Syria, or if you're going to declaim against the lack of democracy in Libya, why not declaim against the lack of democracy in Saudi Arabia, which is by far the most barbaric state on the planet today? Daniel, you can't escape this fact. Surely into the equation must come principle at some point, surely. Because this, I think, feeds this growing anti-politics that we see in the US that I think has helped to bring Donald Trump to the fore, because of the way that the US political class continues to follow this hypocritical line when it comes to these relationships, surely. And these relationships have only resulted in disaster. The Middle East can in no way be considered a success in US foreign policy terms. It's a disaster. It's a defeat.
You have made many points. Let me just pick up on one, which is that the Saudi regime is the worst in the world. No, not by a long shot. It's a miserable regime. I'll agree with you, but it's by far not the worst. Part of it is the beheadings that you point to. Part of it is the Wahhabi ideology it spreads that I pointed to, and much else. But one can work with the Saudis, and as you implied before, it behooves the U.S. government to pressure it. And I wish the U.S. government had done so over the decades. I believe that we should work with these dictators, whether it be kings or generals or presidents. We should work with the dictators, and we should, in general, push them to open up, to allow more political participation, to rule according to the law more, and over time, I think we could make a big difference. We have abdicated, U.S. government has abdicated that role in much of the Muslim-majority countries, and that is a big mistake. For example, Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, he was in power power for 30 years. With the exception of 2-3 years in the early 2000s, we didn't do that. Had we done so, I believe Egypt would be in much better shape today. But we didn't, and we haven't done it in Saudi Arabia, and we haven't done it elsewhere. I agree, a mistake. It has to be done carefully, slowly, without leading to revolution, but it should be done.
Okay, we're just going to halt there for a short break. Join me in the second half of the show, where I'll be further discussing the issue of US-Saudi relations with Daniel Pipes. Hard Facts. Welcome back to Hard Facts, a show that gets to the heart of the matter. And today I'm joined by Daniel Pipes, and we are discussing the issues surrounding the US congressional vote to overturn President Obama's veto on families of the victims of 9/11 from pursuing civil action against the Saudi government. Daniel, can I just ask this question? And please, I'm not being trite when I do so. What gives the US a moral right to be involved in the Middle East, to have this presence, and to essentially act as a grand chess master when it comes to the Middle East and its governments? Because what you're outlining there is hard power politics. Very pragmatic, and I have to say, very honest to your credit. But it does smack of arrogance, does it not, that one power, Washington being the new Rome, can have this sway in the Middle East. Surely this is the cause, the root cause of all the problems and instability, not only in the Middle East, but in Eastern Europe and in the East and South China Seas, is the fact of this projection of US power and hegemony. Surely you can see that conceptually has failed on its own terms.
Well, you're making two different points. What gives them the right and arguing that it's failed? Let me stick with the first one now. In the first place, we've been asked in by virtually every country. We're speaking in particular of Saudi Arabia and the Saudis, starting with the famous meeting between King Abdulaziz in 1945 and Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Yes.
They've asked us. They wanted us there. So, in general, that is the raison d'etre for the American presence around the world. I mean, look at, you mentioned the South China Sea. The Chinese government is on the rampage. And everyone, from the South Koreans to the Philippines, is looking to us for help to stop them. So we're being invited in. We're not just imposing ourselves.
Well, how does that square then, Daniel? Because the legitimate government of Syria has asked the Russians to come in, and Americans are not happy about that. So again, we see a little bit of a contradiction, do we not?
A legitimate government of Syria? That's a pretty funny statement, isn't it?
Well, certainly according to the UN it is.
And the UN is the deciding factor in what legitimacy is? Not in my book.
I thought the US was a signatory to the United Nations Charter, no?
Okay, but just because a government has a presence in the UN does not make it legitimate. Anyway, I don't think we were disputing Russian presence in Syria. I was saying that you challenged the U.S. presence, and I answered it. Now, the second point you made is that the U.S. policy has been a failure.
Yes.
Well, it would be hard to argue that the Middle East is doing well these days, but I don't think most of the problems have to do with U.S. foreign policy. I don't know that there is any foreign policy that could lead to a flourishing, democratic Middle East at this point. The problems of the region are rampant, from Islamism to extensive water problems.
Yes.
And I don't know that any outside power can solve them. And indeed, I don't, as an American, wish to solve them. I see our foreign policy ideally as one that protects us, our interests, our friends, does not aspire to change the region. And when George W. Bush attempted to do that in Iraq 15 years ago, it was a disastrous mistake. No, we shouldn't try and fix Iraq or any other country. We should protect our own interests.
I'd suggest that when we see the proliferation of terrorism that has resulted since 9/11, and I think you're right, and you will agree that the disaster that is Iraq, but also the disaster that is Libya and the U.S., surely this pattern of intervention from outside powers led by the U.S., the constellation of states, whether involving the U.K., France, etc., that has been an absolute disaster, and that surely has to end. And I go back to my point about an even-handed policy. Saudi Arabia is a fountainhead of this explosion of barbarism, masquerading as a religion, bearing forth the flag of religion. I mean, this is a medieval state that believes that women should be treated no better than chattel, that public beheadings, crucifixions, democracy is not even in the vocabulary. That cannot obtain. I go back to that salient point, Daniel. Yes, I understand that you're coming from a very different perspective, but on its own terms, it's not working. There must be a change, surely.
I agree with you that the Saudi regime is a medieval one, and I would like to see my government push it, as well as your government, push it towards modernity. But on the other hand, I do not think that we can fix that regime or the region. We are outsiders. It is up to the denizens of the region to fix it themselves. We can be helpful. We can, at the margins, push in the right direction, but it's up to them. We can't treat them like children. We need to respect them and what they want and protect ourselves. And in the case of the Middle East, there's a lot of self-protection that's needed. This is the source of violence, of extremist ideologies, of diseases, of immigrants who have no skills that are turning up. It's a source of great problem.
Can I just read you a paragraph, Daniel, from a report produced by Human Rights Watch regarding Saudi Arabia's role in the conflict in Yemen, which, as you know, is ongoing, and Saudi had unleashed an air campaign to help put down a rebellion by a Houthi minority in that country beginning from March 2015. And the first paragraph reads, "The United Nations General Assembly should immediately suspend Saudi Arabia's membership rights on the UN Human Rights Council, Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International said today. A two-thirds majority of the General Assembly may suspend the membership rights of any Human Rights Council member engaged in gross and systematic violations of human rights." What do you say to that, Daniel?
I'd say be fine with that if the Iranians were expelled as well.
How do you equate Iran's role in the Middle East or policy in the Middle East with Saudi's
I think it's far, far more aggressive. It is the Iranians who are on the warpath, as I mentioned before, in four countries, including Yemen, which you just noted. Mm-hmm. It is the Iranians who are building nuclear weapons. It is the Iranians who have...
Daniel, can I just interject? What evidence do you have that Iranians are engaged in trying to produce a nuclear weapon?
Need to go through this with me?
Well, from the U.S. intelligence reports that I've read, that there's no firm evidence that they are engaged in building. But there's been allegations, but there's been no firm intelligence that would substantiate that claim.
Yeah, all those fusion machines for electrical power. You really believe that?
Can't say this, because obviously, I think it's fair to say we can't just take Saudi Arabia in isolation in that region, given the dynamics of the region.
Oh, fair enough.
But how is it justified that Israel can have 200 nuclear weapons that are undeclared, but Iran can't have one? What's the difference, if you don't mind?
The Israelis are defending themselves. The Iranians are threatening the world. Very, very simple distinction. The Israelis have had these weapons for something like 60 years. Mm-hmm. They've never used them, never threatened to use them. They simply have them in the basement in case of some dire emergency. The Iranians, when they get their weapons, which is scheduled to be in about 12 years, will change the world. They will be threatening in their apocalyptic way, and it's going to be a disaster and a tragedy.
I have to say, Daniel, I understand where you're coming from, and I know that you're a firm supporter of Israel and so forth, and I would understand why you would say that. But I really don't think objectively that that can be considered an accurate assessment, because Iran, I don't think, has any extraterritorial ambitions, but Israel clearly has. It's built into the foundations of the state of Israel, a greater Israel, etc., and so forth. So, I mean, don't you think that that we need to have some sort of counterweight in the region? And that's the problem. There's been too much emphasis on Israel. Israel deserves to. I am not one of those who think Israel should be wiped off the mark and so forth. And I think the claims that Iran wants Israel wiped off the mark, I do think they've been exaggerated. I think Iran is much more rational than you're giving credence to in your analysis there. I don't think Iran is under any illusions about the limitations of its power, but I think what it wants is some kind of parity, and it feels threatened by the fact that Israel has 200 nuclear weapons, which we know from the classified memo that was released from Colin Powell, are pointed at Tehran. Wouldn't you, if you were sitting in Iran, put yourself in their shoes, wouldn't you feel, wait a minute, we're the ones who are being threatened here?
Iranians develop nuclear weapons. Otherwise, the Israelis want nothing from Iran. The Israelis are surrounded by enemies. The Israelis are defensive. There seems to be a fundamental difference in the way we see things. I understand that certain countries, such as the United States, and now Israel, since you've raised it, are fundamentally status quo-oriented defensive governments, and others, such as the Saudi, the Iranian, and many around the world, are aggressive and seek to disrupt and seek to conquer. I have far fewer problems with the nuclear weapons or other forces of status quo in defensive countries than I do, including Britain, France, than I do with the aggressive countries such as North Korea and the Soviet Union. Huge difference, moral, political difference between the two. Simply to count arms misses the point. You have to look at the nature of the government.
Daniel, we're running out of time. Could I just ask you this? What do you think the outcome will be to this civil action that's now going to go ahead?
Endorsed it. I'm absolutely against it. I think it's mischievous. It's going to lead to enormous problems for the U.S. government, for soldiers and diplomats and so forth. I imagine that it will somehow or other be blunted. It's too disruptive to the existing order to have anyone suing a government at any time. So, yes, it was an extraordinary victory, virtually unanimous, and it was Barack Obama's first override of a veto, so all very dramatic. I think it got more attention than you're ascribing to it in the United States, but I'm doubtful it'll actually work out. I think some way will be found to blunt it.
And as President Obama's presidency runs down to its conclusion, what do you think his legacy will be in terms of his Middle East policy and achievements?
That he pulled U.S. influence out of the Middle East and allowed the Russians in.
Really? You don't think that it was because the U.S. was a defeated power in the Middle East after the defeats in Afghanistan and Iraq?
Had John McCain or Mitt Romney been elected, it would be a very different American foreign policy in the Middle East.
Indeed. As Albert Einstein once said, after the Third World War, the Fourth World War will be fighting with sticks and stones. Daniel Pipes, thank you very much for agreeing to come on Hard Facts, the show that gets to the heart of the matter. And if you want to catch up more on Daniel Pipes' work, you can catch him at his website, www.danielpipes.org. Daniel, thank you very much for agreeing to join us on the show. Thank you.
Thank you.